Today is Wednesday, July 28th. What do you know? It's 1:36 in the afternoon. This is John Williams with a one-day early edition of the Mincing Rascals podcast. In fact, I think we're going to be doing this on Wednesdays now, so adjust your lives accordingly. You can listen to me on WGN Radio weekdays from 9 to noon.
Hey guys, Brandon Pope here, Ebony Magazine, WCIU, and NABJ Chicago Press.
I'm Heather Schroen with WTTW News.
I'm Eric Zorn, the thoroughly disgusted mincing rascal at large.
Even without a full-time job, Eric is able to expand his introduction each and every week. At large, yes. Why thoroughly disgusted, Mr. Zorn?
Well, we'll get to that when we talk about the hearings, the January 6th hearings.
Okay.
We're not gonna start there, so.
Well, maybe we should, but I think people are especially buzzing today about Simone Biles, the best all-around women's gymnast in the world, has stopped competing in the Olympics after a subpar performance early this week. Citing the pressure and her own mental health, she dropped out Tuesday, and it's not clear if she will come back in some individual events. She might. She's 24 years old. When tennis star Naomi Osaka dropped out of the French Open earlier this year, she didn't have a backup, but Biles does. Judging that she wasn't ready to safely or competitively compete, she bowed out and a woman named Jade Carey will now take her place. In her absence, by the way, the team won silver medals. Here's a quick personal anecdote. When I was in the sixth grade, I was the toast of the West Joliet Little League. In the first four games that year, you may not know this, it wasn't widely publicized, I hit three home runs. I was the league's hitting star, and I got so nervous about hitting more home runs that for several games thereafter, I stopped swinging the bat. I struck out all the time. There I was, succumbing to the pressure in a Little League game next to the Holiday Inn in Shorewood. So I have more than a little sympathy for someone who can't bring themselves to performing.
I'll start. I think one of the key word that you used when you're discussing this was safely. Right? It's not just that she's too nervous to go on and perform and we're just like, come on, get out there and go do that. Gymnastics at that level is a very, very dangerous sport. And she described feeling something called the twisties, which I'd never heard of, but this is something that gymnasts experience where you're in the air and you've trained your body to do, you know, 2.5 flips or something like that, and you then lose track of where you are because of nervousness, because of something. And at that point, you don't even know how you're going to land. And there are stories of gymnasts who are paralyzed for life and or suffer a severe injury when they do that. And this is evidently what Simone Biles experienced in her first jump the other night, which is she was supposed to do a 2.5 and only got 1.5 and just felt like she was in the wrong space. And it's a little different. I mean, my first response was, hey, you know, sports is tough. You got to be tough to do this. But when you realize the safety issue involved when you're performing gymnastics at that level, if you're not all there mentally as well as physically, you could really, really hurt yourself. It's not like, well, she might have lost or something. I mean, when John struck out, he managed to move on to another life without any injury. But that's why I think this is something that really does it requires a different analysis than, oh, she got nervous and couldn't compete.
Yeah, I thought about that too, Brandon. I mean, baseball players and golfers get the yips. Chuck Knobloch forgot how to throw from second base to first base. And the consequence of that is you strike out or you don't make the play. But you don't break your neck in baseball if you can't do what you're trained to do.
Yeah, I mean, if you watch these gymnasts, it's amazing, especially the beam events, the level of precision and literal mental gymnastics you have to do to achieve these things. I was talking to a friend of mine who used to be a gymnast, and she compared it to driving a stick, driving a car that's stick, and forgetting how to drive a car that's stick, and you're on the freeway, and everything's rushing around you, and it becomes a dangerous situation. And so that's kind of what happened to Simone here. Overall, I think it should be respected. It should be respected that she is prioritizing her mental health because, one, it protects her and her safety. But it also, she mentioned, this benefits the team. She felt like she could hurt the team and the team's performance overall, Team USA, because of this that was going on with her. She didn't want to be an impediment to their success. So she stepped aside. And this isn't the first case of athletes doing this. We had Osaka recently, but let's be honest here. This is what athletes have done. They do this for years. And we see the yips. We see different things that mentally get into these athletes' mind. That's why we have sports psychologists. Even Michael Jordan, he took a break from basketball at the height of his career because of the things going on in his life. That was a lot of that was for his mental health. He probably didn't say it back then, but it can be assumed that way. So I think we're in a different era where players feel empowered. Athletes feel empowered. Generationally, I think we're seeing millennials and younger people just say, hey,
that's an interesting point.
I got to step aside.
Yeah, yeah. You know, Heather, you weren't here with us last week, but we talked about Ben Zobrist, whose divorce was so cataclysmic to him personally that he bowed out of the game in 2019 for 2/3 of the season.
I have, as I've said, I have an almost 12-year-old and a 9-year-old, and we've been watching the Olympics together, and they were both really excited to see Simone Biles and the team. Neither of them are gymnasts, but I think they see themselves in Simone and the other team members. And it turned out that it was actually a really good opportunity to talk about the need to set your own boundaries and sort of ask for help when you need help. I said, well, you know, what would you do if you, my older daughter swims, you know, what would you do if you, you know, if your arm felt really bad? Well, I wouldn't swim. Okay. Well, what happens if you felt like your brain was hurting? What if you were really sad? And it was a really good opportunity to say, you know, sometimes our bodies don't live up to what we sort of want them to do for any number of different reasons. And the same is true really with our minds. The New York Times did a big profile of Simone Biles just before the Olympics. And she said that basically she didn't want to come back for the 2020 Olympics, that she felt that she had to come back to represent the victims of Larry Nassar, the doctor who was engaged in multiple abuses of the 2016 Olympic team while the Olympics were going on. So that she wanted to come back so that there was a survivor on the team and that the USA Gymnastics and the International Olympic Committee wasn't going to be able to sweep under the rug what had happened to all of them. I appreciated it as an opportunity as a mom to say, hey, if you need help, ask for help. It's a good lesson for all of us. And I think that everybody who spends their life tapping on a keyboard or talking for a living should probably have several seats before they think about saying what Simone Biles should have done in that situation.
That said, we are all going to offer our opinion. But one thing that I would like to add here is that you really know that this was serious because this is going to cost Simone Biles that the Wheaties boxes and the endorsements and all the love that was going to flow her way after this Olympics, whether she finished first, second, or third, whatever. She is, you know, the greatest of all time in gymnastics. And this, she knew, she had to know, people around her knew that this is probably not going to play well for her future commercial prospect. So she made this decision. This was not a decision made lightly. It wasn't, she was like, well, maybe I won't win. Maybe I'll come in second. This was something very serious. And I think we have to respect that, even though those of us who don't do this for a living or don't have never been able to turn more than a somersault really have no idea what goes through the minds of an athlete like that. So I got, you know, my view of this is, well, I really trust what I see from her, that this was something that she really felt she couldn't do. And it would have been a really, really bad idea. And it was worth whatever it was going to cost her.
And I think we got to acknowledge, too, how different this year's Olympics are. In a global pandemic, cases are rising. There's no fans. Friends, family could not come to Tokyo, unlike past Olympics. That's got to play a part, too, in not having that support system around you that you're used to being able to be right there with you through competition. All of that has to factor in here. The pressure these athletes face, I'm privileged enough to have covered an Olympic Games in 2012. And when you talk to these athletes, they're from 8 years old, they're facing extreme pressure. At some point, you know, it's got to get to you. So, yeah, I salute anyone that says, hey, I need to take a step back and prioritize health, not just mental health, just my health overall.
But you know what doesn't help her case is that she stood there then with her teammates, which was a nice way to look at it. But also she looked physically able. There did not seem to be anything wrong. And if she were just a petulant star, the sort of person that Heather suggests she's not, and I think we all second that, but that's what that would look like. If she was just like, I'm not feeling it, or I don't want to do it, or I don't like what somebody said, that's what it would look like.
Kind of like Jay Cutler face, right?
Totally. I mean, really, look how we judge the last set of women's Olympics gymnasts for their faces that they would make, the pouty face or the whatever, if they weren't happy with the medal. Let's believe that what she's going through is genuine. But while she's standing there, you're thinking, lady, stop clapping and get out there and do the dang thing. You know, was it a case of her realizing, I can't win the gold, so I'm just not going to do it because I'm not feeling it right now? Or was it a real crisis? That's what that argument looks like.
I see it. But again, I want to go back to the safety issue, which is it's not, she's not swinging a baseball bat at a ball. She's out there throwing her body many times over and over itself in the air and then trying to land on her feet. And that is something that you have to be in the right place to do.
You should see my text line today. So I guess when the going gets tough, the tough don't get going.
And it's so damaging. It's somebody who's depressed or somebody who's struggling with anxiety. You can't sort of present your injury to other people for mm-hmm. them to judge. And that's what part of what makes mental illness so difficult. We're in this society that praises strength and grit and sort of just getting it done and putting your nose to the grindstone. I think it's so damaging to hear, because if you've ever experienced depression or anxiety or loved somebody who has experienced depression and anxiety, it's not something that they can just will themselves out of. And first, you know, we have to remember that Simone Biles is literally the most decorated gymnast of all time in any country, in any era, and competed in the 2016 Olympics while passing a gallstone while having several broken toes.
Well, you know what I don't like too is when athletes will sometimes say, all right, I'm going to stay in the game. And, you know, I think that's a little selfish in a way. Like, God bless you. We know you want to help the team out, but the coach or somebody has an obligation to say, yeah, but 80% of you is not as good as 100% of the guy on the bench. So you're out. I appreciate the effort. So Simone may have put herself in that position and said, regardless of my own desire to compete, I don't have it today. Put somebody else in.
If she whips it, they don't.
Yeah,
that could hurt them.
Thank you very little.
She may still come back next week, right? The individual all around, is that next week?
She can. Well, she said, my understanding is, I'm not expert on exactly how the gymnastics meets work out at the Olympics, but I think she's not going to compete in the overall, but she might in some individual events.
In the individual events, not the all around. Yeah, I misspoke.
Right? Yeah,
but
yeah.
I think that's the last thing that happens. So,
somebody sent me a text today, and a guy said when he was a kid, he was 11 or 12 years old, and he learned to play the accordion, and he competed and won in a local accordion competition. And so they decided to put him on local TV here in Chicago. And they said, 3, 2, 1, you're on. And he just sat there and froze and couldn't move. And they had to escort him off the stage on TV. The guy said, I'm 71 years old, and I am still to this day humiliated by that experience. And
yeah, it's relatable. I've done that.
What's that, Brandon? What's your version of that?
7th grade spelling bee. You know, easy word, a gimme, pristine, PRISTINE. And I would have won the regionals, went to the big, you know, script spelling bee, and I whiffed it. I whiffed it.
How did you spell
completely.
It? Do you remember?
I forgot. I put a
double E maybe.
Yeah,
P-R-I-S-T. I put an I in there where it didn't need to go.
It's amazing how these things stick with us. All the things that we've done, we've accomplished, but we forget all those. We remember our spelling
bee
failure.
That thing is always going to haunt me. Always.
Yeah, but at least, I mean, so really, right, we chuckle about that. And it's not the same as what she went through. But the fact that we remember that says something then about how difficult it must be for Simone Biles to not only go through that, but to make the decision that I'm not going to go out there. Insider.com reported that the Olympic Committee found that in elite athletes, including Olympians, rates of anxiety and depression may be as high as 45%. That's a quote from them online today. I suppose I believe that.
It strikes me with gymnastics that you make one, they're performing these incredibly difficult feats, and you make one little mistake, and it can cost you a medal, or, and in baseball or basketball, you can, if you make half your shots in basketball, you're considered a really good player. If you get a hit 3 out of 10 times, you're considered a great baseball player. But if you wobble on the balance beam, you're a clumsy oaf. So, I mean, I can imagine how the anxiety level would really, really ramp up in sports that are so exacting like that.
You got to think, too, about these sports that aren't glamorous, you know, table tennis. You know, there's not a lot of money in table tennis. So these kids are also thinking about what their parents are putting in to help them realize their dream. They don't want to let them down, and they don't want to let down the country. They're playing for the country. Oh, man, the magnitude of that. That is unimaginable pressure.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't even think I could handle that.
Well, there's a skateboarder named Nia Houston who is supposed to – he was the Simone Biles of skateboarding. He got 7th, and he cited the pressure from the games, and he's just like, I didn't perform as well as I know I can. By the way, the other event that I love every Olympics is criticizing the coverage of the Olympics, and NBC – came through in flying colors with what I thought was a subpar performance, although I did think they handled the women's gymnastics story pretty well. And the interview with the team after they won the silver, including Simone Biles standing there, why didn't you compete, was awkward, but I think everybody managed that very well. But last night, just as a for instance, Britain got 2nd, 3rd, got the bronze. You did not see any of them. It was like they weren't even there, to say nothing of Italy and Japan and the host country. They, you know, pay their billions of dollars to have the rights, and then they get to tell the story any way they want, NBC. And I wish they would just believe that we are a little more patient or curious to see something other than Americans swimming laps in a swimming pool. They cut away briefly to 4 inset screens, and they said, there's other things going on NBC-owned properties if you want to look at them. And then they showed badminton, which is insane at that level, men's volleyball, rugby, where one guy picked another guy up into the air, threw him into the air, and then he caught the ball, and then they cut away. And I thought, I don't know what the hell that was, but that was pretty cool. And then there was something else going on. I'm thinking, this is all better than swimming. Let's watch something else here. But no, we got to watch damn swimming.
Whereas I was saying, don't cut away from the swimming. Don't do it. Don't do it.
There must be more Heather Sharones than John Williams in the world.
And they build up the stories. They did tell a really good story about the Australian swimmer who beat Katie Ledecky. It was a head-to-head matchup, and did a really long feature on her and her crazy coach before that race.
Yeah.
And so it's not like they don't pay attention to non-American athletes, but very – and there was also I believe a Chinese gymnast who fell off the high bar, and they did a segment on that as well. He was, I guess, he was the Simone Biles of men's gymnastics. And so they occasionally do, but yeah, I think the focus, they've discovered that people like to watch gymnastics and swimming, and they don't care about badminton, and so they're not going to show you any badminton, even though you probably could build up a pretty good storyline about badminton team.
I think it's chicken and egg, Eric. We love swimming and gymnastics because that's what they've fed to us all of these years, and if they, who knows, maybe we're badminton nation and don't know it.
I just say that I have to go to Peacock TV, some streaming service, to watch USA basketball lose to France. Like,
yeah, God, but we, but then by golly, we showed the world we beat Iran by 50 or 60 points. And I'm like, all right, well, let me know when you beat Brazil again or Spain or somebody, one of the East European countries that is more competitive.
Now, John, we can go back to not caring about any of these sports for another, 3 years now.
Right? I know. Really, yeah. If I really cared that much, I guess I'd know who the good badminton players are. COVID-palooza starts tomorrow. The governor and 100,000 other people from around Chicago and the Midwest are going to pack into Grant Park, maskless, not entirely vaccinated, for a festival that the city's health director continues to endorse. If you had tickets to go, or if your kids wanted to go, what would you say?
No.
Oh, man. I mean, if it was me, maybe? Well, I mean, there's a lot of caveats. Do I have VIP access?
No. No.
Access to water?
No.
None of that?
No, you're a random drunk 17-year-old teenager is what you are in this scenario.
I'm passing all the way. Yeah. Can't do it.
John, what you're forgetting is that fans, attendees have been asked to adhere to the Lollapalooza fan health pledge.
Yes. You want to repeat it for us, Eric? Fine. Have you memorized it? Put your hand on your heart here.
You're supposed to wear a mask whenever you're around or wherever you're close to people. You know, mask in the mosh pit. You're supposed to have a COVID test within, was it 72 hours?
72 hours.
And you're supposed to, if and then you have a vaccination record, you're supposed to show them. If you don't take the COVID test, you've got to show your vaccination card.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You're supposed to sanitize your hands a lot and so on. No, it's not going to be safe. There was this story out of in the Netherlands where there was a Dutch music festival. About 1,000 people out of 20,000 attendees in a 2-day festival tested positive. So about 5% of the people tested positive for COVID after that event. Lollapalooza may have up to 400,000 people over 4 days. And so that's going to, if you got, you know, 5% of that, you're going to have, you know, tens of thousands of cases out of Chicago. And, I think it's a bad idea, and I think we've said this on this podcast before, which is, I really believe that if they had known back several months ago what the situation was going to be right now, they would not have allowed it to go forward. But now here we are. You've got all these people coming into town. You've got all these tickets sold. You've got all these bands booked.
That is similar to what we said last week, and yet it does feel a little more, I don't know, ominous or something as we continue to get closer and the COVID numbers continue to get worse. But you're right. This thing has momentum. I mean, there's no turning back now.
I'm not so sure that Lightfoot wouldn't have permitted it, even if she knew that we were going to have rising cases at this point. So consistently, we've seen that the mayor was less willing to shut things down than the governor was. And I think that she wanted Lollapalooza to go forward because she had been promising for months before she allowed it to go forward that the summer of 2021 was going to look different, more like the summer of 2019 than the summer of 2020. But the Delta variant does what the Delta variant does. Very beginning of the pandemic, Mayor Lightfoot did not want to shut the schools down. Mayor Lightfoot did not want to close indoor dining. She did not want to close indoor dining in October when the second surge hit. The city knew this was a possibility. The city is going to go forward with it. I think that, you know, the city has leaned very heavily on the fact that Dr. Allison Arwady, the commissioner of the Department of Public Health, is an epidemiologist. And they have said literally, look, she's an expert. Trust her. And I do not think that she misspoke when she said that she could only be hopeful that Lollapalooza would not be a super spreader event, and not competent, which was what Marianne Ahern of NBC5 asked her. And I think that she chose those words very carefully.
Well, she's working for her boss, isn't she? I mean, imagine, sure. I'll bet you already knows this is a bad idea, but she's Fauci to Trump in this case. She can't say what she really believes.
She has to walk that same line. You know, it's a bad pun, but I'm holding my breath because this seems like we've got to get through this and maybe we will. But it's so terrifying.
And it's the summertime, too, which is interesting or terrifying. And you've also got data out of places like Louisiana where the curve, the age curve, is now skewing dramatically younger. That the people who are being hospitalized, they used to be in their 70s and now they're in their 20s. That these new variants that are coming on. The Tribune had a really long thing this morning. It had all the letters in the Greek alphabet and all the various variants that are out.
All the way
there.
Down to Lambda now or whatever.
I know it's I'm going to have to finally learn the Greek alphabet, I think. But it'll help me win crossword puzzles. So there's that silver lining. But I agree with Heather that this is a very scary time. And again, it's summer. Last year we had this nice dip in the summer. Remember, everyone thought, well, maybe we're going to get over this. And then it came roaring back in the fall because people all go inside and they start sharing the same air. And so this is a really tough time. And again, I'm all for vaccine mandates, as many as we can possibly impose on people.
Well, I think it's maybe hopeful to remember that we've been going through 40,000 people at Wrigley Field and we haven't seen a jump. There have been other festivals in the city and in Chicagoland, and we haven't seen jumps. I know that this is different on a scale, but a lot of the things that we're citing have been happening writ a little smaller, and we've been surviving it. It's outdoors. It's a younger population. The reason you're seeing an uptick relative to the rest of the population of young people is because old people have been largely vaccinated. The governor's going to go. I do trust Allison Arwoody, even though the optics of this thing look terrible. Maybe we will dodge this bullet. 100,000 adults, maybe 200,000, if you say two parents for every kid, let's just say that, have determined that it's okay for their kids to go, and they're going to go. Nobody's putting a gun to their head.
Or did they?
You can get out of here for, give me a weekend.
During the beginning of the pandemic was a lot of talk about not getting COVID at all. And it was like, if you get COVID, you know, that you have a really high chance of getting really sick and ending up in the hospital or maybe even dying. And that made sense at the beginning of the pandemic. But I think the question now that a lot of us are grappling is, will COVID become sort of an illness that you get and that you suffer and then you survive? Is it going to become like the flu for people who are vaccinated? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And do we need to learn to live with a certain amount of risk to live our everyday lives and sort of go about our business, acknowledging that we're not going to be 100% protected from COVID, but you know, maybe some level of COVID is going to become like the flu. Nobody wants to get the flu. If you're smart, you get a flu shot every year. Is this part of the process of being like, okay, I was terrified of COVID a year ago. We can now manage this as a virus in a better way. So maybe I do get COVID, but maybe I don't have to be as terrified about it.
But think about it this way. Yeah. Think about it this way. Influenza is a terrifying word. Influenza is flu. Influenza killed right. millions of people. Now every year you get a flu shot and you don't think twice about it. Maybe we'll do that with COVID. Maybe we'll do exactly what you said. COVID scared the hell out of me. Now I get my COVID booster shot every fall and I'm good to go.
Of all these festivals, this lineup doesn't even look like it's worth trying to catch COVID.
This is what Austin said last week. What's the lineup?
It's not even that great compared to past years. I mean, past years you'd have big headliners like Chance the Rapper, stuff like that. This year, you got Miley Cyrus.
Foo Fighters.
The Foo Fighters. Post Malone. I like Post Malone, but, you know, these aren't like big, huge A-list.
Look, I'm putting it out there right now. If somebody I know goes to Lollapalooza and they get COVID because they wanted to see Limp Bizkit, we're going to have words. Because I cannot condone that. That may be a friendship breaker, okay? Like, don't put your health at risk to see Journey, okay? Just don't do it.
Really, if I promise you you'd be healthy, I'm not sure you should do some of that. Chicago area Congressman Adam Kinzinger fought through tears as he spoke at the Select Committee hearing on the January 6th uprising at the Capitol.
You guys all talk about the effects you have to deal with, and, you know, you talk about the impact of that day. But you guys won. You guys held. You know, democracies are not defined by our bad days. We're defined by how we come back from bad days, how we take accountability for that. And for all the overheated rhetoric surrounding this committee, our mission is very simple. It's to find the truth, and it's to ensure accountability.
Four uniformed officers spoke about their experience warding off the mob. Only two Republicans are on that committee, and they're famously critical of the former president. So does the committee suffer for the absence of more critical voices and eyes and ears? Based on what you've seen and heard, Brandon, what's your thoughts about the hearing so far?
Emotional and mind-boggling that anyone could see this as a partisan issue. Like, this is it's so clear when you have police officers who are explaining the sense of terror they felt. They're talking about the racial slurs that were thrown their way. They're talking about all those things that you don't want to hear officers have to go through, and they face that at the hands of a mob of people who were incited to violence by a man who lost the presidential race. That's all it comes down to. And for anyone to see it any other way is, at this point, it's lunacy. And when you hear these officers talk, yet you have legislators who at the same time dismiss what they're saying, say it wasn't an insurrection, but still claim that Blue Lives Matter or claim that they're pro-police, you got to question that, because you're hearing your police officers right here on the line of duty risk their lives and some died, and you're trying to say it wasn't that big of a deal. That's ridiculous. So to me, the whole thing we're seeing right now, it's like, duh, this is so obvious, everybody. So obvious.
Well, I don't think we learned a whole lot yesterday that we didn't know, those who were paying close attention to what happened on January 6th. But I think the nation saw quite a bit of stuff that maybe they hadn't seen before. And it really was just a curtain raiser day on what we're going to learn as this investigation goes forward. We knew that there was a lot of terrible stuff that happened to the police and that people said terrible things and so on. But what we don't know yet, and what we're going to find out, is the role of the Republicans, basically, who were involved in funding this and in downplaying it, in inciting it, and what they did on that day to stop it or not to stop it. That we are going to now get into sort of the granular details behind that. But this yesterday was just really a reminder of how horrible it was. And part of that reminder, and the why I said I was disgusted earlier, is the reaction that Republican spokespeople, Republican pundits had to this, which is they were dismissing some of these police officers as crisis actors, as liars. And they kept trying to change the subject to, well, what about the George Floyd protests? And rather than making the kind of effort that Adam Kinzinger in the New York Times today said that if we fail to get to the bottom of this, if we don't do this hearing right, Kinzinger wrote that he would have serious doubts about what the future looks like for America and for our democracy. That this is a much more important event than anything that happened on the streets of Minneapolis in terms of the future of this country. And the fact that Republicans are downplaying it, not taking it seriously, that Leader McCarthy is trying to portray Adam Kinzinger and Liz Cheney as Pelosi Republicans is disgusting. It truly is. It shows such a lack of integrity, such a lack of character that I am dismayed by.
But this is so predictable, Eric. I mean, without another Republican voice, and granted, they would have allowed some other Republicans to be there. But at the end of the day, you only have two Republicans, and it's Cheney and Kinzinger. And for most Republicans in America, they don't count now. So whatever this committee comes up with, whatever truth that Kinzinger finds, is going to be tainted by half of the country who are going to say, well, yeah, it was a bunch of Democrats digging at Donald Trump. That's what that was. That's not good enough.
I don't worry about it because I think there's a whole segment of the population that is absolutely irredeemable, that you could have had all the Republicans you wanted on that committee. They're never going to turn on Trump. They're never going to believe anything other than that this was blown out of proportion and or that these rioters, these insurrectionists, these terrorists, as one of the officers called them,
tourists,
were there in the service of a noble cause, which was to defend our democracy against Joe Biden stealing the election.
Couldn't there have been a way for them to craft this committee so that you did have somebody who wasn't Jim Jordan, but also wasn't Liz Cheney? Or could we not have found moderate, doubting voices who would have added a more critical edge to this thing?
Well, that was supposed to be Rodney Davis, right?
I think there are a couple things happening here. One, it was it was the minority leader Kevin McCarthy's decision to pull all of his nominees to the committee. Yeah. Once Jim Jordan and Jim Banks were not allowed to sit on it. And I think that Nancy Pelosi's reasons for not allowing Jim Jordan to sit on the committee make sense to me, because he could be called as a witness. He spoke to Trump on January 6th. And I don't know how you can have a member of the committee investigating something that at least he appears to have information on. And then, Jim Banks basically said, look, it wasn't an insurrection. He denied the facts on the ground. So I don't know how you move forward with those two people on the committee.
I agree. No argument here. Okay, fine. But find somebody else.
Yeah. Well, the other thing is, so that was Kevin McCarthy's decision not to let anybody sit on the committee. And you have to understand that the House GOP is incredibly, incredibly right wing at this point. Even after the insurrection, a majority of members of the Republican caucus voted not to certify Joe Biden's presidential election. So you're working on a very, very, the only possibilities are very, very, very small. And you just, at some point, you have to say, well, if you're not going to agree that the sky is blue, it doesn't, your presence does not add to sort of our examination of sky color. And
no, but that's the problem right there, Heather, because what if it was to determine the color of the sky, and we all go, but no, everybody can see it's blue, it's blue, it's blue, it's blue. Well, you are as predetermined. I mean, let's assume for a second that we don't know what happened, or we're trying to get to some truth that we don't know. That's the purpose of this thing. Then if the other team says, well, it's blue, case closed, then that is as predetermined as the other side might be resistant. I mean, it's the same thing, just flipped on its heels.
It's a really hard thing to sort of parse. There's no doubt about that. But at some point, you have to say you aren't dealing with the facts on the ground, and that your presence doesn't add anything. And I was struck by yesterday's, the difference in tone from yesterday's committee meeting and the impeachment hearings right after the insurrection, where you had people like Jim Jordan able to question witnesses and that sort of thing. And it was a very somber, saddening committee hearing. And I don't know that would have developed if you had somebody like Jim Jordan perhaps shouting about people being crisis actors.
To extend your analogy a little bit, John, it's like if we were having a hearing as to not whether the sky was blue, but we all know the sky is blue, but let's find out why the sky is blue. And then you've got people on this committee who are denying the basic thing. I mean, we all know
that that's
there
good.
Was this terrible
I'm
riot
following you.
At the,
yeah.
at the Capitol.
Yeah.
Now we need to know why. We need to know all the details behind it. But if you've got people on this committee who refuse to acknowledge that it happened or that it is important to find out what happened, then they're just clowns. They're just distractions. They're not helping us get to the bottom of the question. I think you're right. I was very interested in the fact that Rodney Davis, the downstate congressman, who is sometimes mentioned as a statewide candidate in Illinois, and right after the January 6th insurrection, he said that it's imperative that we fully investigate how it happened and we need to take steps to make sure it never happened again. Well, he was supposed to be on the committee. He was then, of course, pulled off as McCarthy pulled them all off. And now he's carrying on about Nancy Pelosi's partisan ploy and stand up for the patriots who are being attacked falsely for January 6th. I think Rodney Davis has just completely screwed his political career in Illinois as a statewide candidate. He may get reelected over and over in whatever district they draw for him downstate. But that kind of statement, that kind of attitude about this hearing is not going to play well statewide with Illinois voters. And I think he is toast now, along with just about everybody else in the Republican.
I'm wondering how voters are going to read this, because this hearing, I think we can all agree, should have happened a long time ago. Like it feels very, very belated. And so I wonder if at this point, do you have some voters who are going to look at this and be like, oh, wow, the Democrats are just really stretching this thing out and using this for whatever political points they can? Or do voters truly want an unpacking, more of an unpacking of what happened that day? We all saw the news coverage. We all, you know, like you said, the things we heard from the officers weren't exactly new. So I do wonder if some voters might sit back and think, why are we even doing this right now? What is the reason? What is the purpose? If not politics.
Somebody described it as a curtain raising, you know, the first scene in what's going to be a hopefully pretty thorough investigation, and that the presentation by those officers was just sort of the opening act. I was thinking that same thing, Brandon, while I was watching this. I thought, however traumatic this was for the officers is kind of beside the point. It's how did this happen? How did it unfold? Who's responsible? These guys are victims, if you will. So it adds some electricity to this story, but it doesn't, even if the Republicans were there and said, yeah, that sucked for you, that doesn't answer any of the questions I have. So I'm kind of curious about the direction it goes.
Well, there have been some analogies made to the Benghazi hearings, which Republicans were all excited about that. if you remember. They had umpteen hearings about Benghazi. They put Hillary Clinton on the hot seat for, I think, 11 hours answering questions under oath about what happened at Benghazi. And arguably, Benghazi was a military failure and a failure of intelligence, but it didn't threaten the very democracy on which our country is founded. And so for Republicans to say, hey, let's move on, forget about this, never mind what happened or the origins of it or who's responsible, is the height of hypocrisy.
You know, Brandon, you also mentioned the amount of time that this took. I am also thinking about the investigation of the individuals who stormed the Capitol themselves. The story in the Tribune by Jason Meisner about the Joliet area couple charged with breaching the Capitol was interesting, and it answered some of my questions. That is, how the hell does it take so long to find these people, round them up? They posted it on Facebook. Just go get them, right? I just wanted to read from the article. The Joliet area husband and wife who were arrested Monday on federal charges alleging they breached the Capitol took photos inside the building's historic rotunda. John Schubert, 71, his wife Amy, 61, of Crest Hill, were charged with a criminal complaint filed in Washington. According to the complaint, the couple were identified in part by a plumber's and pipe fitter's local union jacket that Amy Schubert was seen wearing in a lengthy video posted to YouTube. Right? An investigator in Washington, D.C. doesn't know who these people are or where they are, but you go, aha, a Joliet plumber's jacket. Okay, how does that help me? Investigators were able to determine that a phone linked to Amy Schubert was one of only six devices with a Joliet area code being used inside the Capitol at the time. Somehow they're able to get the phone numbers of all the devices that were inside that building and then go, which one of them are 815 area codes? Oh, there were eight of those. Oh, we have a Joliet plumber's thing. I wonder if that's the same one. Not necessarily, but then the investigation goes on. So you've got all these layers of the onion, you got to keep peeling back until you finally come up with a picture that matches her records, et cetera, and then they get her. And so it's after all that, it's misdemeanor charges, right? Maybe it'll be a slap on the wrist and they'll get away with it. But I'm very frustrated that it is taking this long to round these people up and give them, you know, whatever punishment you can.
Yeah, it looks like they're winning. Like they thought they could go in brazenly and storm the Capitol when they did.
Yeah, well, here we are coming up on August, and so far they have. And if they then, I don't know, I don't know what the appropriate punishment is going to be for this couple, right? They go in, they were in, but they didn't punch or kick an officer, let's say. Let's say they were just part of the mob. I'm not sure what's supposed to happen to those people. No sympathy for them. I just don't know what the appropriate punishment is.
Well, we can look at what has happened to the first couple of people who have sort of fit that profile. They entered the Capitol. They, you know, walked around. They didn't engage in any violence. So they've been given probation and community service and sort of, required to apologize. And so the one person whose case has sort of made it all the way through, and he didn't commit any violence, but he did enter the Senate chamber. He's going to jail for 8 months. So, but there was one woman who just entered the Capitol and she got probation and community service. So I think that's where it's sort of the lines are going in terms of ultimate punishment. I think that this is a huge, one of the largest investigation in the Justice Department's history. It's going to take them a while because of course nobody got arrested, or at least very few people got arrested as they were leaving the Capitol, which means it is more complicated. And I think it's worth pointing out that, you know, this Joliet couple was the 12th and 13th Illinois resident to be arrested for entering the Capitol. And
what about that? Is that high number or low number to you?
So it's about in the middle. But I think that sometimes we can make the mistake in thinking that Illinois is a very blue state, and so that these people aren't our neighbors, or that we don't know them, they're not in the union with us. And I think that there's probably more people who, if given the chance, would have done these things than we think. And, I think part of the court process and the committee process is to sort of agree on that common set of facts that's so challenged right now. And I think part of that work will be done through the outcome of these court cases.
I can't even imagine having the audacity to do something like this. Like, I once, I'll confess, lifted a extra cookie from Whole Foods. When I was, they put it in the brown bag. They ask you how many you got. I said I had one, but I had two. I admit it. I'm sorry.
Hang on. I'm calling 911 right now, Brandon. I can't let that stand.
Well, even that, I had anxiety and I still am stressed over this. So I can't even imagine doing something like this and just being like, yeah, I have the right, the audacity, the will, and no one's going to do nothing about it. And yeah, we ain't seen nothing.
I'm less interested in the people who sort of wandered in with the crowd and took a look around while wearing their MAGA hats. I'm more interested in bringing to justice the people who tried to gouge out the police officer's eye or who used an American flag to beat on a police officer's head. Those people, I would love to see them do some serious time. I'm not sure that a whole lot is going to be gained by putting in prison some of these people who, like I said, just kind of probably joined the protest and, hey, the doors are open. Let's walk in and see what's going on.
I think that was a lot of it.
This is history. I think you do have to sanction them. I think probation, community service, as long as they don't have any other aggravating circumstances behind it, is probably, you don't want to fill up the prisons with people.
And you don't want to make them martyrs either, right, Eric? I mean, I suppose if the crime were too small and the punishment were too great, that might kind of backfire in the minds of some people too.
Well, Donald Trump is trying to make a martyr out of the woman who was Ashley Babbitt. Is that her name? The woman who was shot and killed trying to break across that barrier when she was protesting in there. So, I mean, so their ability to make martyrs out of people who don't deserve to be martyrs is unparalleled.
Let's talk briefly about the police contract. $600 million maybe is what the city will be out for. What are some of the numbers on this one, Heather?
Well, the deal right now would give officers an average of 2.5% raises dating back to 2017 and extending to 2015. So that's an 8-year deal because the officers have been working without a contract for more than 4 years at this point. And the reason why the deal took so long to reach is because Mayor Lightfoot refused to reach an agreement that did not include significant reforms to the way that the officers who are accused of misconduct are evaluated. So for up until now, for 40 years, if you wanted to file a complaint against a Chicago police officer, you were going to have to sign an affidavit under the penalty of perjury with your name saying that officer, Joe Schmo did X, Y, or Z, and here's my address and my phone number. And oh, by the way, if you want to talk to me or maybe send some of your buddies, here's where I live. So there were a lot of people who were reluctant to do that. So that was flagged by the Department of Justice's investigation in 2017 as being problematic for holding officers accountable for misconduct. So that requirement would be removed under this contract. The other thing that would change would end officers' ability to change their statements to investigators after reviewing audio or video of the incident. So right now, let's say an officer shoots somebody who is running away from them. They can wait 24 hours to make a statement to investigators. And then if they make that statement and then see the body-worn camera footage, they can go back and change their statement. Mm-hmm. And that was also considered sort of an impediment to holding officers accountable, because if you can be held accountable for lying to the FBI, which I do not recommend, why aren't officers held accountable for lying when they're being investigated? So those two things would change. And I think that Mayor Lightfoot sees those as really important changes to the way that the police department operates. Now, the police union said, we only want to deal with finances. We're not going to agree to any reforms. And I don't think that happened. So the big question is now, will the rank and file members of the Fraternal Order of Police Lodge 7, will they ratify this deal, which will mean a significant amount of back pay?
Yeah.
So this is going to be about $30,000 for each officer going back 4 years. And that is not a small amount of money. And the city is, of course, going to figure out, have to figure out a way to pay for that. Now, the city has about $100 million saved up for this. How they're going to find the rest of it, I don't know if it's exactly $600 million, but that's the ballpark of it. But this had sort of been, you know, lingering out there for a long time. And I think everybody is pleased that there's some agreement that includes some sort of reforms. Whether it's acceptable to the rank and file, I think is an open question. Can it make it through the city council? That's also an open question.
There's also a requirement in the new contract, the proposed contract, that gets rid of the requirement that police disciplinary records older than 5 years be destroyed, right? So we get to keep older disciplinary records?
So I don't think that that is really a win for the mayor here, because there's a new state law on the books that requires that those records be preserved. So that was going to go into effect, really, whether this, once this contract got renewed one way or the other.
I just saw
that. She was bragging about it anyway. My understanding of how they're going to pay for this is they're going to be refinancing loans. That was what I was trying to read some of the stories this morning and figure out how they're going to pay for this.
That's Mayor Lightfoot's favorite budgetary technique. You or I and Brandon, if we want to, you know, buy a fancy car, we basically only have three options, right? We can make more money, we can borrow money, or we can spend less on food, right? Like that, those are the three options.
Steal more than just cookies from Whole Foods.
Exactly. Absolutely.
That's going to haunt you, Brandon.
So the city has somewhere in the neighborhood of $7 billion in general obligation debt outstanding. So what the city has been doing repeatedly, I might add, is taking a chunk of that debt and basically saying, hey, we'd like to refinance this debt. So it's just like refinancing a mortgage. You might get a lower interest rate, but maybe the payments extend for longer. And that's essentially what the city is going to try to do to get through this next budget year, which will be easier because of the federal relief that has come to Chicago as part of the COVID relief, but is going to be brutal because the city's pension debt has just grown astronomically. Mm-hmm. And the city is going to have to pay a significant amount more toward its pension. And it can't really sort of get out of that obligation with these fancy techniques.
I'm going to interpret Brandon's eye roll just a minute ago, though. It's like this, $30,000. Harder to vote against $30,000. Did I read you right on that, Brandon?
You read me right on that one, man. Yeah, it's going to be... I think Lightfoot can at least be happy that this is somewhat coming to a resolution before her reelection starts ramping up.
That is no small thing. This deal would extend 2 years into the next mayoral term.
Am I the only one who is galled by the fact that the city knew that this debt was going to be accruing? They knew they were going to have to give the officers raises. I mean, and $100 million they had set aside for it was not going to do it. And they had to know that. The fact that it's six times that. More irresponsible kicking of the can down the road.
I mean, they didn't really have any other choice, though, because the pension costs have been skyrocketing and, you know, personnel costs have been skyrocketing. You know, had it been possible for them to sort of save this money, they knew it was coming. I think it's probably 6-1 hand, we can't afford to do it, and a 6-1 hand, we don't want to do it, because it will make the city's budget picture look even worse than it actually is.
Yeah. Don't you hate it when cities manage their money the way you and I do as well? It's so irresponsible. Heather probably actually has a very clean financial ledger, and maybe Brandon and Eric do too. But I don't. I am out of time. You know how sometimes you guys have to click out? I have to click out. So this is John Williams clicking out. But Brandon, thanks for joining us. Heather, the same. And Eric Zone, it's good to see and hear you guys. Thanks for being on the podcast.
Talk to you soon.
See you all.
Bye.
Right. Thanks, Brandon. Thanks, Heather. Good to see you. Bye now.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNRadio.com.